My name is Jerry, and this is the Wild Eye Podcast. The Mind of Conservation, Dr. Andrea Marais Portrita. Hello, everybody. So before I hand over to Gabby for what is a fascinating conversation with a super interesting guest, I wanted to just read you a little bit of something from the website of Dr. Andrea Marais Portrita, who Gabby is chatting to. Now, the link to the website is in the description, so you go scratch around. But just for a bit of context, what is conservation psychology? So I'm just going to read a little bit off the website here before I hand to Gabby. Psychology needs to get involved in the discussions about environmental issues because these issues are a result of human psyche and behavioral choices. So we need to understand people to understand our environmental crisis. We also need to understand the impact of the environmental crisis is having on the psychological well-being of people. Now, conservation psychology and eco-psychology are both fields that explore the relationship between humans and nature, whereas environmental psychology typically focuses on the broader influences of the physical environment, including built environments, design, and aesthetics, on human behavior and well-being. Now, conservation psychology came about in the late 1990s and early 21st century. Mainstream psychology focused on the individual and the social world, but there was no focus on the natural world. So conservation psychology primarily examines the psychological processes underlying human behavior in relation to conservation and the preservation of nature. It explores how individuals perceive, value, and interact with the natural environment and seeks to understand the factors that influences pro-environmental attitudes and behaviors. Conservation psychology aims to develop strategies for promoting sustainable behavior and fostering environmental stewardship. It asks, what is the human place in nature? And what is nature's place in the human being? So, just the last paragraph. As a conservation psychologist, I am, and this is Dr. Portrita, interested in reconnecting individuals with nature on a deeper level, fostering a sense of awe, wonder, and emotional connection that'll make people realize that there is a reciprocal relationship between humans and nature, and that we need to conserve nature and biodiversity for its intrinsic value, but also our own well-being. Now, this is fascinating stuff, and it speaks to a lot of my passions, both obviously nature conservation and then the psychology side of it as well. So I'm now going to give you what Gabby presented to me here. So officially, I'm going to hand over to Gabby, and the intro would go something like this. What if saving the planet started with understanding the human mind? In this episode, Gabby chats with Dr. Andrea Marais Portrita, a conservation psychologist whose work explores how our thoughts, fears, and values shape the way we treat the natural world. From Western leopard toads in Cape Town to community projects around the globe, Andrea reveals why real conservation begins within and how hope, empathy, and imagination can change everything. Together, they unpack the psychology of conservation, talk about the emotional side of climate change, and explore what it truly means to accompany another species. This conversation will invite you to pause, reflect, and ask, what kind of relationship do I want with nature? I have no doubt you guys are going to enjoy this one.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Wild Eye Podcast, the space where wild stories meet strong opinions and real conversations about conservation. I'm your host, Gabby Sikora, and I've come to believe that protecting the planet isn't just about saving wildlife, it's also about understanding ourselves. So, my guest today is Dr. Andrea Marais Portrita. She is a conservation psychologist who studies exactly that, how our emotions, values, and worldviews shape the way we connect with nature. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me, Gabby. I'm very excited.
Awesome. I am too. I can't wait to get into things. So from the Western leopard toads of Cape Town to global projects imagining better futures for people and our planet, Andrea is showing that real change starts in the human heart. So wherever you are joining us from, out birding, driving, or dreaming up your own conservation journey, settle in because we're diving into the psychology behind hope, action, and our relationship with the wild. Now, Andrea, before we get into all of your incredible work, if we were sitting in one of your favorite wild places right now, where would it be and what would we hear or feel around us?
Wow. That's a beautiful question, Gabby. Sure. Wow. I have so many different wild places that I really feel close to and that evoke a sense of awe inside me. But the place that I think I have the closest connection with at the moment is a small private nature reserve called Bunghook, and it's on the west coast of the Western Cape. And it's really small. It's about 1,000 hectares. And I think the sounds that you would be hearing would be waterfalls, actually. And it would be winter. Yeah. And it's just a beautiful landscape. And we've got leopards that occasionally walk through. And when you walk around, there's aardvarkspoor. And even a protea canary, if you're lucky. So I thought that would be my place. Yeah, the reason that it's so special is because it's surrounded by intensive agriculture. So it sort of forms like a little womb of biodiversity in the middle of intensive agriculture where nature can really just come and breathe in this little space.
That's amazing. So it's just like a little pocket of just this huge amount of biodiversity.
Yeah, exactly. It was an old farm, actually. Many, many years ago, it was a potato farm, I believe.
Okay.
And it was just, actually, nature rewilded itself. So once they stopped farming potatoes, nature just slowly started healing and rewilding itself. And that's what we see today in this nature reserve.
That's incredible. Wow. You must be so lucky to just be surrounded by that. I can just imagine the waterfalls hearing that around us. So yeah, now we have the scene painted. Now we just have to imagine ourselves being just immersed in that. So now you mentioned that you are a conservation psychologist. Now for listeners who might not know what that means, how would you explain it in everyday terms?
Okay, so there's various ways to explain it. So I'll explain it in two ways for your listeners, but also just to say that it's an emerging field. And that's why I say there's various ways of explaining it, because I think practitioners are still finding their way. We even see ecologists moving into more of a emotional domain of understanding people's relationship with nature. Wow. So the two ways that I would describe it is the first, which is the camp that I sort of work in and that I identify with, and that is understanding people's emotional relationship with nature to benefit conservation actions and to benefit conservation plans, where you can then include communities, indigenous and local culture and knowledge, etc., in how you promote conservation strategies, especially for endangered species, which I feel quite passionate about. Yeah. But then there's a second way that I can describe it, and maybe it's not entirely conservation psychology, but more eco-psychology, but I also straddle a bit in that world, and that is understanding our emotional relationship with nature and how that impacts our mental health. And that would be the second way in which you can probably define conservation psychology. And that kind of space would look into why we need to conserve biodiversity for our own internal microbiome and mental health, and how to counter things like depression and anxiety. So the one way is looking at it through a nature lens, and one is to look at it through a mental health lens.
That is absolutely incredible. That is so, so interesting. Wow. Now, was there ever a moment or an experience that made you realize people's minds and hearts are just as important to conservation as science and policy?
Wow, sure. So many moments, though. But the one that stands out for me is I have to go back to what I call my previous life when I was a consumer psychologist. Okay. And in that job, I had to understand people's psychology and how they relate to inanimate objects like brands. So it could be cars, chocolate, coffee, chewing gum, all those delicacies as humans indulge in. And I was on a project in Ethiopia for a big global brand trying to understand the psychology of mothers and how they relate to this particular brand. And something shifted in me in that moment where I realized that I can use this understanding of human psychology and how people relate to brands which are inanimate, how different psychologies relate differently, how you would then need to communicate to people differently and design policy that is a little bit nuanced. And I can use that to benefit nature and animals, animate objects, not objects. I think they're not objects, they're beings, they're sentient beings, and how I can use those skills to actually benefit nature. And I think that was probably, I would say, the most important moment, really, where the shift happened for me. So I think that would be my story to describe that. Although every day there's moments, you know, that emerge.
That is really interesting. I didn't know you had that, you could call it backstory, before you got into, you know, animal psychology and stuff. But just quickly, for our listeners' interest, how did you go about, like, with uni, and what did you study and specialize in to get to where you are today?
Oh, great. Yes, such an important question. So initially, I studied journalism. So I did a Bachelor's of Arts in journalism because my dream was to become a war journalist. So I've always had this desire to tell the stories that remain untold, or the stories that go unseen amongst people. And at that point, I felt things happen in wars that never get heard, stories that never get told. And as I started doing my BA in journalism, I majored obviously in journalism, but my second major was psychology. And the rest was absolutely history. I fell in love with the human psyche. And after the BA in arts, I did a honors in psychology, followed by a master's degree in research psychology, and then my doctorate in psychology, specializing in environmental psychology.
That is so interesting. Okay. And where did you study all of this?
So I studied at University of Johannesburg, the journalism degree, because no other universities at that time had offered that degree. It was quite new at the time.
Yes.
And actually, there were a group of us studying journalism that felt psychology is critical to have as a second major in studying journalism. And we had to motivate for that. And that's how new the degree in journalism was at that time. So I did my BA and my honors and my master's at University of Johannesburg. I kept on getting bursaries, which is quite a good way for University of Johannesburg to keep students in the system. And after my master's, I worked in the corporate sector in market research. And then I had my own research agency. Then was the Ethiopian moment of awakening, which I described.
Yeah.
And I closed my business, and then I did my PhD at Wits University. But also, maybe, Gabby, to mention that when I was doing my PhD at Wits, at the same time, in parallel, I did a practical course in eco-psychology with the eco-psychology school in Italy, with the beautiful and amazing Marcella Janon. So I did a course as well in that in parallel with my PhD to give me some practical experience.
Wow. You sound very knowledgeable. Like you've got your doctorate, everything. Wow.
Thank you.
Amazing. Okay. So now I want to move into people and understanding, you know, the human psyche, like you just said. So now you've studied how people think and feel about nature. What are some of the biggest differences you've seen in how people relate to the natural world?
So I think I should first start by saying that the one key learning in my research was that our relationship with nature is really complicated. And the way that you describe people's relationship with nature depends on what lens you're using to look at it. So the lenses that I initially used when I started doing my research was, as you earlier mentioned, worldviews, values, personality. I'm very passionate about personality and how that influences and shapes our worlds. And then also childhood experiences. So what makes people's relationships different to nature would really be a combination of all those things. So some people grow up, and that's their childhood experiences, in families that may be quite exposed to nature. They go to the Kruger, or they grow up in rural areas where they really understand the natural world and they live in close relationship to it. But that can change when you start speaking to people that have grown up in urban environments that never really, you know, have been exposed to really biodiverse places. And then you get something in between. And I've really seen that, especially in particularly in South Africa, that, and in urban environments particularly, there's six different types of relationships that people can have with nature, and that is predominantly influenced by these psychological landscapes, which include our worldviews, our values, our childhood experiences, traumatic experiences, our connection to nature, which measures our emotional relationship with nature and how we see ourselves in relation to nature.
Wow, that's really so interesting. I'm absolutely in awe. Like, I have no words. I'm struggling to reply back on here because, I don't know, it's just you have this vast amount of knowledge and being able to put that into practice and it's like you're able to see the world so differently than the average human being. And I think that is absolutely incredible. But now, during COVID, you explored how fear and uncertainty changed the way people saw climate change. Now, what did that time teach you about human behavior and hope?
So that was such an interesting study. So we went into COVID, and the first thing I wondered was, how would something like COVID, this big global unknown zoonotic disease, impact our relationship with nature? And actually, I did two studies at the time. I did one research study across South Africa again. And then I did a second study that included some European countries, but it was a really small sample size. And what I found was that the fear of our own death, because that's what COVID did. COVID made most people realize, oh my goodness, I can actually die. If I go to the shop and I don't wear a mask and I pick up the virus, I could die, or I could take the virus home and somebody else I love could die. So the fact that we can die really became quite prominent in our psychological landscapes. And what my study found was that COVID enhanced our relationship with nature. And what I mean by that is that if people were very connected to nature before COVID happened, COVID enhanced that. They became more connected to nature. They felt more love, more awe, more at home in nature, or if they were in an urban environment, a deeper desire to get into nature. But for people who weren't really connected to nature before COVID, during COVID, they became more disconnected from nature. And the threat that enhanced or decreased people's relationship with nature was just the fear of our own death, because that's what COVID really made us all realize, how fragile the human life is.
That is so interesting. And I'm just thinking about our daily life, you know, during COVID and stuff like that. And I also truly believe that as a family, we also became more connected to nature during that time. A silly example is, obviously, we couldn't go out to our national parks and stuff. So we really got more into garden birding and then set up all of our water features, our bird features. And we went really in depth with that. And it became like a daily habit of going to the window, checking what's in the garden, then naming the birds. And they literally became like part of, I wouldn't say part of the family, but it became this connection, this deeper connection. So that's really, really so interesting that you also, you know, from your research, you also found that.
It's fabulous. It's beautiful what you did during COVID as a family. Yeah, and that completely is a very accurate example of what manifested for many people.
Yes. And that was the good side. I mean, there were also some negative sides of like depression and all of that stuff, not being able to go out. But yeah, you will obviously know all of that from all of your research and stuff. But now it feels like people care about nature, but they still struggle to act. So from your experience, what helps someone move from I care to actually doing something about it?
Wow, sure. That is such an important question, but quite a difficult one to answer. And why I say that is that when you look at research specifically that's been conducted globally, we always get contradictory results. So some of the research would say women are more inclined to act compared to men. And then you get research that shows you something different. Research that says people in their mid-20s to mid-30s are more inclined to act. And some other research says older people that are retired are more inclined to act. And so the research isn't really, you know, very accurate. So, some say that when people have more knowledge about what they are contributing to, they're more likely to act. But then you get the behavior gap theories that say actually there isn't necessarily a link between knowledge and behavior. So there's no one accurate answer. But what I've seen is that to get people to act, from my perspective, is to get them to care. And to get them to care, you have to connect them to nature. So take people out into nature and show them how interconnected our lives, our physical and our emotional and our psychological lives are with how nature operates. But of course, there was a new paper that was just released that showed our relationship and our connectedness to nature decreased by 60%, which is very concerning. Yeah. And I think maybe it's because so many people are moving into cities and urban environments, which makes getting them to connect to nature a lot more difficult. You know, so it's a very complicated question to answer. But what I can say is that I met an amazing woman that works with, she works for Transfrontier Africa, and one of their programs, they take gogos and grandmas into nature reserves where they've lived next to their entire lives, but they've never been in a nature reserve before. And so technically they connected to nature, but they've never really seen maybe an elephant or a lion. Yes. And sometimes just something small like that, like providing people to access wild spaces which they've never been able to access. Like everybody should be able to access wild spaces, because that's how we remind people that they are connected to nature, exactly. Which means that they will care more for nature.
Exactly. And what you said in the beginning of answering that question, it reminded me of this one very famous Jane Goodall quote. I think it goes along the lines of only if we understand can we care, and only if we care, we will help. And when you were saying that, it just reminded me of that quote, and it rings so true, because if you don't understand, then there's no real connection there, because if you don't understand something, why would you care about it? So I absolutely loved your answer. And yeah, I mean, that's really what we try and do at YWP, is to really bring that connection back between the youth and nature, and, you know, inspiring the youth to go back into nature, go take their images, go take their photos, and really to just strengthen that connection.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's very important for the youth to get out. And actually, there's an incredible program called Wild Shots Outreach that runs in Hoedspruit. And I don't know if you've ever heard of it, Gabby.
I have not. Tell us more about it.
So they work with youth. I only met them last week for the first time. And they work with youth in areas where they've never been able to necessarily go into wild nature or the Kruger. And they teach these youth how to take photos and how to connect with nature through photography. And the work is just absolutely incredible. And the youth now that have gone through this program have incredible photography skills. But what is more important, they now have a close relationship with nature. So I think photography, obviously, it's not the only pathway to connect youth to nature, but it's definitely what I can see a very important one.
Exactly. I agree fully. Now, just give us the name of that program again, please.
It's called Wild Shots Outreach.
Wild Shots Outreach. Okay, perfect. I'm going to do some research after this and have a look into it. Thank you for mentioning that. Now, on the topic of youth and in that discussion, now, if you could give young conservationists one small mindset tip to stay motivated and positive, what would it be?
Wow. Can I give two?
Yes, you're right.
So my first tip would be is to never think whatever you do doesn't make a difference. Any small action makes a difference, because it's sort of like the starfish story, you know. You can walk on the beach and the whole beach is full of beached starfish. And you can say, I can never save all these starfish. But you can save the one small one in front of you and put it back in the ocean, and maybe another one and another one. And that's really the mindset, not just for youth, I think for adults as well, because I struggle with that. I struggle to, sometimes I feel I'm not making big enough difference, I should just give up. But we shouldn't. Every small action makes a difference. And then the second advice I would like to give is to start in your own backyard. So a lot of the time we feel we have to go to these big nature reserves and big places and try and solve big problems. But there are environmental problems in our own backyards, like the endangered western leopard toad, which is in my backyard. And that is really how we can start making a difference, is focus on the environmental issues in your community, in your suburb, start a youth environmental group, and start just focusing on your own backyard, because that is also how we create ripples into the bigger world.
Exactly. I absolutely love that advice. Thank you. And the first piece of advice you gave is, it's really so true. And I know it's something that I struggle with a lot. Because you feel like, what impact am I making? Because there's so many global problems, and you feel as though you have to be so high up, maybe in parliaments or whatever, to, you know, get these things done and to protect species and stuff. But honestly, it starts at home. And one of the best quotes that I quote often, so for listeners who've been listening to the podcast for quite a while, I often mention the quote, "It's only one plastic bottle," said 8 billion people. And I think it is so incredible, because you think, oh, what's this one little plastic bottle going to do? But what if everybody thinks that way? So thank you so much for that. And you mentioned a youth organization that's, you know, starts in your backyard and stuff like that. There's an incredible organization called Roots and Shoots South Africa, which I'm a part of. And for any youth listening that are really interested in, you know, doing more for their environment and, you know, getting out and really helping, it's definitely such an amazing organization. And I can't recommend it enough. It's actually part of the Jane Goodall Institute just for the youth. So it's incredible.
Amazing. Amazing.
Yeah. Now, you just mentioned the Western leopard toad. So let's get into that story. I have so much to ask on that. How did you first get involved with the species?
So in Noordhoek, Cape Town, where I stay, there were two women that many years ago, I think like probably now 18 years ago, they were driving at night during winter and they saw all these, they thought they were frogs, all these frogs hopping down this rainy road, wet road, and people were driving over them. And they then found out that it was the endangered Western leopard toad busy migrating to ponds where they go and breed, and then they go back to the gardens where they came from. Okay. And these two women, Alison Faraday and Susie J. Cool, they decided, well, we have to do something. We have children and we want them to grow up and be able to experience this beautiful toad one day and then yes, not go extinct. So they started a nonprofit called Toad Nuts. And they started every winter. They have volunteers that go out and actually carry the toads across busy roads so they don't get run over. Yeah. And yeah, it's actually a very long story, but basically I met them. I said, I really want to help. And I just started volunteering with them, with their group of volunteers, where we would go out at night during the rainy season and we would just help save these toads from being driven over by cars. Yeah. And that sort of grew, my involvement grew with this nonprofit. And eventually we went to court because City of Cape Town wanted to build a road through a wetland. And in this wetland, which is also a road reserve, but it shouldn't have been because there's three ponds where these toads breed. And yeah, essentially, we then went to court to try and save these breeding ponds for the toads. And so my involvement just increased with Toad Nuts through just starting to volunteer many, many years ago by helping toads cross the road. I managed to start getting involved in more complicated problems that we need to try and solve for the toads.
That's incredible. And it's amazing how it can just start with two women who just really give, like they really are so passionate about it. And then you learn more about it, that it's an endangered species, and you see all of this happening in front of you. And you, some people would think, oh yeah, it's sad, but there's nothing that I can really do about it. But then you have that small percentage who are like, you know what, let's do more research and we can really do something about it. And that's what we spoke about previously, of people that care, but then people that care that go into it and really make an impact. So thank you for that. It's such an amazing story.
Yeah. And sorry, Gabby, I just actually wanted to also say, I think it's an example of how you can start small and eventually have a greater impact. Because I think because one of your earlier questions was around policy. And I think the hurdle that we all face is that we feel we have to have impact at policy level. But that's really difficult. Even academics that have worked on problems for their entire lives don't always have impact at policy level. And I think what Toad Nuts shows us is we don't have to, obviously it's great to have impact at policy level, but that's not necessarily where you need to start. Start small, start in your community, start with a species that you're passionate about and slowly work your way up, and everything makes a difference. Every toad that they picked up made a difference.
Exactly. I love that. Now, I read your website, I read your bio, and something that I read that came up quite often is the term trans-species accompaniment. Now, could you describe what that really looks like in practice?
Yes. So trans-species accompaniment was a term that a psychologist called Garrett Barnwell introduced me to. And it's actually based on the idea that when a human is busy dying or busy going through a difficult moment, and another person accompanies that person through that process, that is called accompaniment. But what he described to me was what I was doing in my work through this toad, this leopard toad work, and going to court and accompanying them through the court process. That was trans-species accompaniment. So instead of accompanying another human through a difficult process, I was accompanying the endangered Western leopard toad through this difficult process of going to court to try and protect their breeding ponds. So trans-species accompaniment, I think, can be used in so many different ways. I don't know if you've seen the documentary Kulo.
Oh, yes, the pangolins.
The pangolin, Kulo, And what that pangolin walker does, so that pangolin walker helped Kulo on the journey towards getting healthy and eventually being released. And that pangolin walker, basically what he was doing is, in my terms, would be trans-species accompaniment. So there's different ways in which we can accompany different species through processes, you know, whether it's a court case and we're trying to be their voice, or whether we're walking with them trying to get them healthy so they can be released again, or you know, accompanying them when we're at a workshop or a meeting and we try and speak on behalf of nature so nature can have a voice. That's accompaniment. And that's, I hope it's making sense, but that's basically what accompaniment, trans-species accompaniment is.
That's incredible. I didn't know that. You learn something new every day, I guess. So thank you for sharing that. That's amazing. Now, I want to kind of dive back into people and that connection. But also imagining better futures. So you've worked with communities all over the world, imagining what a positive future for nature could look like. Now, how do you help people picture that future?
Yes. So I'm currently involved in a global project looking at imagining desirable futures, because the future we can imagine it as this apocalyptic kind of future that you see in the movies, or we can imagine it as a future where nature flourishes and humans flourish and there's balance between people and nature. So I focus on desirable and positive futures in this project that's in China, Costa Rica, the Netherlands, West Africa, and Canada. And in some of those countries, we include indigenous and local communities, especially in Costa Rica and Canada. And what we use is the IPBES Nature Futures Framework. And that framework really looks at three lenses in which you can imagine a positive and desirable future for people and nature. The one lens is seeing nature as having a right to exist for its own reasons. Okay. The second lens is seeing nature as being connected to nature through culture.
Okay.
And then the third lens is seeing nature and how it benefits society. So it gives us clean water, it gives us material that we can use, etc. So what we do is we run multi-stakeholder workshops. And what I mean by that is we run workshops where we include conservationists, policymakers, indigenous and local communities, researchers, and you include as many different types of people in this workshop, and you try and imagine a positive and desirable future for people and nature using those three lenses. So usually you would come up with three different types of futures: one where nature has a right to exist for its own reasons, one where nature benefits society, and one where nature is connected as culture for people. And we really try and be creative in these workshops, because people struggle to use their imagination to think positively because we're exposed to so much bad news about nature.
Yes.
So that is the most challenging thing in these workshops is to get people to really put the negative stuff aside and really think about positive futures. And we use different time frames. So for some of the workshops, we would say, imagine this positive and desirable future by 2050. And in some workshops, we say, imagine it for 2100. And people come up with very interesting outcomes in these workshops, like using technology more to protect nature or using the economy better. What if different endangered species had their own bank accounts and people can deposit money into a bank account for pangolins? And whenever there needs to be a new rehabilitation center, they can just withdraw money for their own rehab. So very interesting and
very
different
interesting,
ways, to start thinking about the future that isn't something that exists now.
That's incredible. Now, like you said, there is so much negativity and it's very difficult to get that negativity out of people's minds, because often I think we often look more towards the negative side of things. We kind of cut out the positive side of things. If you kind of know what I'm saying, we always remember the negative. We don't always remember the positive things that happen in life. But now I want to kind of dip into that positive side a bit more. So what's one thing that you've seen in those workshops that have given you personally a real sense of hope?
The biggest thing that I've seen in these workshops is really when people come together and you try and we try and include as many people with different worldviews and values and upbringings and backgrounds and cultures in these workshops. And what you end up with at the end of this workshop is a bunch of people who really have a mutual vision for nature, because everybody then seems to be on the same page. And what gives me hope is that those people feel inspired to go out and make these visions happen. Some people say, oh, I'm going to start a nonprofit focusing on this little technological component that came out in the workshop, and I'm going to see if I can make it happen. You know, so getting people to imagine a new way of solving some of our biggest challenges we're facing as humanity and actually wanting to go out and start doing something about it, taking action to make those positive visions become a reality.
That's incredible. I love that. Awesome. So now you've spoken before about the connection between nature and mental health. Now, what does that relationship mean to you personally?
Yes. So I'm a city slicker. I grew up in Johannesburg, in Melville, and I wasn't really ever very connected to nature. But I also suffered a lot from depression when I was younger. And when I compare that to who I am now and where I take time to go and hike and immerse myself in nature, I can see how nature has really reduced my deep sadness that I often felt when I was younger. And mental health, you know, I think a lot of people struggle with mental health, not just people in cities, actually, from what I've seen. And what it means for me is that if people can just take a little bit of time, even if they live in a city like I did, and like what your family did during COVID, to sit in your garden, have a sit space where you observe nature, where you breathe with nature and get to know nature and get to know yourself. And some research suggests 20 minutes that you can sit in nature, which will have a positive impact on your mental health, because your stress hormones start decreasing, your rest and reset and digest system starts kicking in again. So what it means for me is to make time every day to spend a little moments in nature.
That's amazing. I love that. And you've actually kind of answered my next question. It was along the lines of, when somebody feels stressed or disconnected, what are some simple ways to feel grounded again? But I think you've answered that. So thank you. So now, how do we make sure that everyone, not just scientists or activists, feel that they belong in conservation? How can we help that?
I think by making conservation broader And what I mean by that is that you don't only need to be an ecologist or a zoologist, for example, to go into conservation, but there's really a big movement to start incorporating anthropology in conservation or the social sciences like psychology. Yes. So conservation, I think to get people to feel like they belong in conservation is to make conservation more inclusive, also to get Indigenous and local communities more involved in conservation. Conservation, yes, in my perspective, needs to be broader. So somebody like me, who studied psychology and journalism, can actually contribute to the field of conservation, just like somebody who maybe studied photography can contribute to conservation. And that's how we get more people empowered to contribute to conservation, is by making it broader, more inclusive, and more collaborative.
I love that. Okay. And now, kind of extending on that question a bit, what role do you think storytelling or creativity plays in helping people reconnect with the natural world?
Oh, wow. Sure. That is a beautiful question, and one that is so important. I think storytelling, I mean, as humans, you know, our ancestors used to connect through storytelling around a fire. And storytelling is a way that we pass on knowledge from generation to generation. It's a way that we connect with each other and to nature. But an example of the power of storytelling that I want to use to answer your question is, in City of Cape Town, there is a huge problem with human baboon conflicts at the moment. And there's been a lot of media coverage around what the City of Cape Town wants to do to solve the problem, which is quite horrific. And you get people that hate the baboons, and you get people that love the baboons, and then you get something in between. And there's an organization called Empath Theatre. And what they did is they worked with a researcher to research people's relationship with baboons. And through storytelling, they created a play that shows this intimate and sometimes quite a conflicting relationship between humans and baboons. And through this theatrical storytelling, they are trying to shift hearts and minds around the human-baboon conflict. And that's a very powerful example of how storytelling and creativity can help conservation through a play. Just to tell stories, they took all these different research interviews they did, and they wrote this beautiful play about the human-baboon relationship.
That's incredible. And I've just thought of another example that I can add on to that. There's an organization, I think it's based in the UK. I think it's called Protect the Wild. And I recently came across their page on Instagram. And what they're doing is they are taking things that happen in everyday life, for example, the fox hunting in the UK, which is a huge problem, and they've created basically an animated video and put emotions into the foxes. And for example, there's a fox mom with a baby, and then the whole story carries on, and then they get hunted and stuff like that, and really putting emotions to the animals, really pulls on people's heartstrings. And that's also a great form of storytelling to really show what is actually happening right beneath our noses, but we don't realize it. So I think it's absolutely incredible.
I think that's beautiful, because storytelling is such a critical way of engaging people emotionally. Yes. And I think the example you've just shared is a beautiful one, and a very powerful one as well.
Yeah, exactly. And I think also going back to YWP, linking that back, also as photographers, we want to share stories through our photos and add emotions and connections to that. And that's also a form of conservation storytelling. So there's honestly so many things that we can actually delve into and talk about, but there's so many examples.
Absolutely.
Okay, Andrea, to kind of wrap things off, when you look ahead after all the challenges and research and activism, what gives you the most hope?
There's many moments of hope for me, but the most recent one was really when I met some of the youth that's gone through the Wild Shots outreach program here in Nieuwspruit. And that gave me incredible hope, because there's one youth that through photography, you know, she rekindled her innate relationship with nature. She did her pilot's license and she wants to become a pilot in conservation. And those stories, like, my hair is even standing up telling you about that. Those stories give me hope, and the youth give me hope. And I know a lot of adults say the youth will solve all our problems and they will save the planet. But really, I think adults as well. I mean, you know, Outshots, this program was started by adults for youth. So it's not just all on the youth's shoulders. But I do think youth that find their passion in nature, whether it's they want to become a pilot or a photographer or a conservation psychologist, those stories give me hope. And also to see passion, that really gives me hope.
That's amazing. I absolutely love how you answer that. And yeah, literally, I had goose flesh thinking of that. It was amazing. Thank you for sharing that. It's really so inspiring. And Andrea, thank you for such an honest and inspiring conversation overall. I thoroughly enjoyed it. And I think today's chat really proves something I've believed for quite a while now. So that conservation doesn't just start in a policy document, like you said, or a nature reserve. It starts with the stories we tell and the choices that we make every single day. So if you'd like to explore more of Andrea's work, head to conservationpsychology.co.za. And if something in this episode shifted how you see your connection to nature, tell us about it. Email me at gabysycora@gmail.com. And we'd love to hear your thoughts. But thank you so much once again. I absolutely loved it.
Thank you so much. I also loved speaking to you. And I think this is such an incredible way to talk about people's relationship with nature through a podcast. So well done. I think it's incredible work you're doing, Gabby.
Thank you so, so much. And yeah, thank you to our listeners. Until next time, keep your mind curious, your opinions wild, and your heart grounded in the natural world. I'm Gabby Sycora, and this is the Wild Eye Podcast.